BBC.
BBC.
You're with the BBC.
Hello, I'm Harriet Gilbert. Welcome to a special BBC World Book Club coming from the South Bank Arts Centre beside the River Thames in London. This month we've been reading a book that by widespread consent is one of the greatest novels of the last half century. A Pulitzer Prize winner, a massive international bestseller. It's called Beloved. And here to answer questions about it from BBC listeners around the world and from a large invited audience is the novel's author, the African-American Nobel laureate, Toni Morrison. Toni Morrison, welcome to the World Book Club.
Thank you. It's a delight to be here. Well, and to see this extraordinary collection of readers.
I'm amazed you can see them at all, that your eyes are even open, because you've just flown into London this morning, haven't you?
I have, and I'm fast asleep.
Well, luckily for us, Toni Morrison is in fact more resilient than that. The Nobel Prize in Literature can knock an author for six, but since she's won it in 1993, she's written three more powerful, beautiful novels, including most recently A Mercy, that extend even further the imaginative space she's created. Toni Morrison's fiction not only brings African Americans' history to life, but explores with intelligence and subtlety the ways in which power can be abused in relation to race and class and gender. It also gives us gripping, haunting stories. Beloved opens in the 1870s. Slavery in America has recently been abolished, but in a small house in Cincinnati lives a young woman called Setha, who prematurely freed herself and her children from slavery when she escaped a vicious overseer. Setha now lives with her teenage daughter Denver and with a violently disruptive spirit whom everyone accepts is her other daughter, a baby whose throat she cut when the family was about to be recaptured and whose gravestone is carved with one word, Beloved. Into this tragedy-frozen household arrives a man called Paul D, who is a slave in the same place as Setha, and who briefly seems to exorcise the spirit. But then, as a kind of tentative love seems to be putting down roots in the house, a mysterious young woman appears. And Toni Morrison, would you read from near the beginning of Beloved, when Denver and Paul D and Setha are all out together, and from the river this woman steps out?
They leave the carnival and they arrive near their house and they see this woman in a hat and a lovely dress sitting on a stump. And they approach her and offer her water. The woman gulped water from a speckled tin cup and held it out for more. Four times Denver filled it, and four times the woman drank as though she had crossed a desert. When she was finished, a little water was on her chin, but she did not wipe it away. Instead, she gazed at Setha with sleepy eyes. Poorly fed, thought Setha, and younger than her clothes suggested, good lace at the throat and a rich woman's hat. Her skin was flawless, except for three vertical scratches on her forehead, so fine and thin, at first they seemed like hair, baby hair, before it bloomed and roped into the masses of black yarn under her hat. You from around here? Setha asked her. She shook her head no and reached down to take off her shoes. She pulled her dress up to her knees and rolled down her stockings. When the hosiery was tucked into her shoes, Setha saw that her feet were like her hands, soft and new. She must have hitched a wagon ride, thought Setha. Probably one of those West Virginia girls looking for something to beat a life of tobacco and sorghum. Setha bent to pick up the shoes. What might your name be? Asked Paul D. Beloved, she said, and her voice was so low and rough. Each one looked at the other two. They heard the voice first, later the name Beloved. You use a last name, Beloved? Paul D. asked her. Last? She seemed puzzled. Then, no. And she spelled it for them, slowly, as though the letters were being formed as she spoke them.
Toni Morrison, thank you very much indeed. And now a question from the World Book Club audience here at the South Bank Centre.
Hello, Toni. I'm Ginny Drake from Uxbridge. And I wondered, where does one start to write a story such as Beloved? It is such a complex story. Did it grow out of one or two characters that formed in your mind? Or did you have a story outline first? Where did you begin?
Most of the novels begin for me as concepts, just ideas. I was thinking generally about women, one of whose most perennial, powerful, recognized characteristics is their nurturing characteristics, how women traditionally take care of other people. And I wanted to track that in several instances, one of which is a woman's love for her children, and the other was a woman's love, romantic love, and the other was religious love. In all of those instances, it was as though the woman loved the thing more than herself, always put herself aside in order to love something that much. So that was sort of an interesting idea. I didn't have much of a story. And then I remembered a newspaper story about a slave woman named Margaret Garner who had killed her children and was in jail. Infanticide was not that strange among slave women, particularly if the father was a crew member or some rape situation. But the interesting thing in the article was, according to the journalist, she was not crazy. She was very calm, and she was very coherent, and she said she would do it again. And that was more startling than the act to the journalist. So I took that story of a mother loving a child enough to kill it. You know, it's a grotesque, horrible thing to do. Under what circumstances could that emanate from something that we think of as lovely and nurturing, which is mother love? So that's how I began. And while I was writing it, I was sort of trying to think of situations in which that would be a good thing to do. I couldn't come up with anything. And then I thought the person who ought to answer that question would be the girl she killed. Nobody else had that legitimacy. And so when she surfaced, then everything else was clear. That is to say, I knew I had to have a ghost, but I also wanted her to have a plausible real life. And, you know, everything emanated from there.
Now, another question from the audience here for Toni Morrison.
Hi, I'm Frances Merivale. Beloved is one of my absolutely all-time favourite books, and in fact I took it off the shelf this morning and was distressed to find the pages were falling out because I've been through it so many times, so very pleased to meet you.
Thank you.
I think one thing I find so exceptional about the book is the prose itself, and it feels so relevant to the narrative, and I'd love to know whether that came easily when you wrote it or whether it took endless redrafting. To me it feels very physical, and I wonder if it was physically as well as mentally exhausting to write it.
Some parts were paralyzing to write. One or two places where I would write a little bit and then I'd get up and walk outside. But generally I do a lot of revision, a lot, 6 or 7 manuscripts. When I first started writing, I thought if you didn't get it right the first time, then I'd just throw away stuff.
Your writing, Toni Morrison, may use simple language, but it also, in fact, uses very precise, beautiful language and particularly rhythm. And we have a question which was emailed from Ivory Coast, that also refers to the language in Beloved. It's from Dauda El Hadji, who writes, Toni Morrison, in Beloved, you transform the consequences of racism into a poetic chronicle of slavery. Is poetry the right way to criticise racism?
Poetry is not any better at criticising racism than prose. I am under the impression that I write good prose. And I tease poets because I tell them, you write good sentences and you just chop them up. But you know, racism is almost too small a word to describe what this language is about. It certainly is about the awful things that can happen under slavery and what it drives people to. You know, you could get a slave woman to do anything if she thought by doing anything she could keep her children. And Baby Sugg is an example of that, who had all these children.
Baby Sugg being Sefa's mother-in-law.
Yes. And she was cheated of them over and over again. But I thought to look at slavery not from the point of view of, first of all, the master, second of all, the man. You know, most of the slave stories are escape stories by enslaved men, and they follow a pattern: bondage, escape, adventure, triumph. And I remember reading about a man in Rochester who took in escaped slaves. Over and over again in his diaries, there were women, a wagon full of women and children. Another wagon full of women and children. So that it was this connection between the mothers and their children and the escape routes that was interesting to me. I didn't want just a freedom story, you know. I wanted something a little bit more complicated than that, about what that kind of situation can drive a person to.
There's a question now for you, Toni Morrison, which comes from Shireen Ratnagar in India. And she rang the programme in earlier to ask this.
This is Shireen Ratnagar calling Toni Morrison from Mumbai, India. I have, as an Indian, been exposed to many genres of Indian literature that deal with marginalisation. But Beloved, I found to be a particularly dark novel. The lack of a wedding was poignant enough, but then the narrative gets even darker. Could you please, Toni Morrison, share with us your perspective as a writer? Do you need to feel the agony, the injustice of it, in order to have the right to use this theme in your novel? Or to do justice to the theme, do you think you have to rise above your anger and your emotions?
Ah. Well, slavery is such a large subject. I wanted to do them justice. I didn't want to make them live happily ever after. Now, it is true that there were moments when I faltered and, you know, I would stop writing for a while until the language was there. But my job was so easy compared to theirs. All I had to do was think about it, write about it, and try to feel it. I didn't have to live it. So I thought, well, if they can endure that life, the least I could do is write about it. But there were moments when it was a little overwhelming for me.
Do you think that, just to follow on from that question, that the moments when you felt overwhelmed by the material, that was actually bad for the writing or good for the writing? And I mean, in other words, is detachment necessary to make the writing effective, or is the emotion, in fact, more necessary?
The emotion is not good. The questioner asked about anger. You see, if you go, you don't get over it, you go through it. So you displace anger because it's just not useful. It's not useful to your gifts. It's not useful to your talent. And you write badly. You got two or three little sentences there of, ah, and then what, you know. And then besides, you know, and you look at these people that I'm writing about, and you look at the grammar, they're not burnt up with anger. The one who's burnt up is Beloved. The girl, she has a right to be a little upset there. So she is distorted by it. And I can write about that, about how it consumed her and turned her into something destructive. But I can't write out of that feeling. You know, I tell you this story. It's a little anecdotal, but my grandmother left Alabama with six children and $30 going north with no idea where she was going. Her husband was in Birmingham, where he had gone to play the violin to earn some money to send back. She said she saw white boys circling that farm, and she had to leave because her girls were reaching puberty. So she sent a message to her husband, and she said, if you want to see us again, be on this train at this time out of Birmingham. And they all got on the train, her and her little $30, and the train moved out of the station, and the children burst into tears because they thought they would never see their father again. And as they got about 25 miles outside of Birmingham, here he came. He had been hiding in the train. But the point was, I always, and there are other stories, I all my life, every time I would try something that I wasn't sure about or something different, I thought my grandmother and my grandfather were watching and that they would laugh at me. If I said, oh, I can't do this. Oh, it's too hard. Because I was thinking, suppose I, at that time, I had, my sons were small. And I thought, could I get on a bus with $30 and just go somewhere, not knowing anyone or what would happen? And I thought, no, I can't. But I can do this thing. So there was always this sort of critical chorus. I mean, they weren't mad at me, but they did expect certain things. That and that was always behind why I'm telling you that my job was to bear witness and not to be afraid and not to be angry and not to fold and collapse because thinking about it was too hard.
Another question from the book club audience for Toni Morrison. Yes, the lady in the front here.
My name's Jean Campbell and I live in London, and I'd like to ask you about a very powerful image about the scars on Seth's back, the chokecherry tree, and the point where there's a transformation of the tree into something beautiful by the white girl. Uh-huh. Where did that come from? That, for me, is one of the most powerful moments in the novel.
Well, I saw a photograph of the back of a beaten slave. At first sight, the scars were bad and you could see the pain. But at the same time, I needed something for the white girl to talk about and for Paul D. Because to him, it looks like beautiful. And it's, on the one hand, really repulsive and ugly and full of pain. But I wanted it to not only be the ugliness that had happened to her.
Another question.
Hello, Miss Morrison.
Hello.
My name is Essie Clark, and I'm from the southeast of England. I've recently rekindled my love of reading, probably one of the most pleasurable and recession-proof indulgences. Beloved was one of the books I committed myself to reading this year. I stress the word committed because I think your book requires just that, commitment. I have a rather short attention span, I hasten to add, and so I must confess to finding the book challenging in places. But I think it was good mental exercise. You say in the foreword that I wanted the reader to be kidnapped thrown ruthlessly into an alien environment. Why is it so important to you for the reader to become actively as opposed to passively involved in your books, particularly with Beloved?
That's very, very important to me. First of all, I like books like that. I like books that you swallow and then you go back, you taste, you chew, something you can read again and again. And it's different each time, or you are. So that's one level. But the other was, it was a kind of connection to my notion in African-American community of call and response. The same thing is true in jazz, in improvisation. Whoever starts it is eventually beholden to somebody else who may take it in another direction. And there was this open-endedness in these stories that I heard when I was very young. And I wanted this real intimate relationship. I wanted the reader to feel as though he owned it and she owned it and participated in it. Now, that desire of mine put off a lot of people. And they kept saying, what happened? Did she die or did she go? Particularly Song of Solomon, they said, well, what was the end of that? And I would say, what do you think? Well,
I see you're certainly not alone in having a short attention span. We also had an email from Helmut Schneider, who lives in Puxi in China. And he said also that he needed a fantastic memory to be able to work out what was going on. But he did say, he said, actually, one needs to read the book twice to fully understand it. And he added, of course, the fact that a second reading opens new dimensions is almost a criterion for good literature. But like you, Essie, he does ask, did it have to be quite that complicated? A question for Toni Morrison from the World Book Club audience over here. Yes.
Hello, Miss Morrison. Hello. My name is Mary Jenkins, and I would like to thank you for the hours of pleasure that you've brought into my life. You were talking about how you involve your audience or your reader in participation with you in the books, and I have noticed that in some of your books, certain words or their meaning are withheld. For example, the given name of the beloved child, and also the double meaning of the word uh-huh.
Well, there's uh-huh and uh-uh. Yeah. I always tell my, used to tell my class, when you think of certain languages where intonation is the most important thing, and I say, how many ways can I communicate with just uh-huh? I can say uh-huh, meaning I don't believe you. Or uh-huh, you know, excitement. Uh-huh. These people didn't have their names. Whatever their names were, they lost them. So the whole naming and renaming business was extremely important. Your last name was the master's estate's name. Baby Suggs has a name, but she's not using it. Her husband called her Baby, and his last name was Suggs. The Paul D's were Paul, what, A, D, and H or something. I can't remember. Showing that the individuality was nothing, you know, even though this man believed that he was raising him as men. Beloved is the name part of a sermon. Dearly beloved, that's all she could pay for with her body. So that the place of names is critical to me because it was so much a part of the people I knew. I was thinking, I didn't know any of my father's friends' real names. And if you think about it, think about musicians from the 40s and 50s and so on. They all were named something else.
Jazz musicians in particular.
Jazz musicians, Satchel Paige. They're all counts and dukes and kings and princes. Except Satchel Paige. Satchel meaning Satchel Mouth. That's what they were calling him. And frequently the nicknames you get are humiliating. so that you can get that information fast. Get it over with. You have bow legs, you call quack quack. You have this thing called, so that, you know, no ego here. This is your flaw, this is your nickname, etc. So that has changed, of course, now, but that was a very, very strong part of particularly 19th century, where people were naming themselves, renaming themselves. It's a kind of act of agency.
Toni Morrison, I think now would be a very nice time to have another reading from Beloved. And this section is told from Paul D's point of view.
Oh, yeah.
He's getting a bit uneasy about this girl who's just appeared from nowhere, who's called Beloved. Who is she? What is she?
This girl, Beloved, homeless and without people, beat all, though he couldn't say exactly why, considering the colored people he had run into during the last 20 years. During, before, and after the war, he had seen Negroes so stunned or hungry or tired or bereft, it was a wonder they recalled or said anything. Who, like him, had hidden in caves and fought owls for food, who, like him, stole from pigs, who, like him, slept in trees in the day and walked by night, who, like him, had buried themselves in slop and jumped in wells to avoid regulators, raiders, patrollers, veterans, hillmen, posses, and merrymakers. Once he met a Negro about 14 years old who lived by himself in the woods and said he couldn't remember living anywhere else. He saw a witless colored woman jailed and hanged for stealing ducks she believed were her own babies. Move, walk, run, hide, steal, and move on. Only once had it been possible for him to stay in one spot with a woman or a family for longer than a few months. That once was almost 2 years with a weaver lady in Delaware, the meanest place for Negroes he had ever seen outside Pulaski County, Kentucky. And of course, the prison camp in Georgia.
Toni Morrison, thank you very much. You're listening to the World Book Club from the BBC World Service with me, Harriet Gilbert. And we've got a question, Toni Morrison, for you now, which was rung in earlier from a BBC World Service listener in Canada. And here she is to ask it.
Hi, my name is Soad Sharabani. I'm a Canadian journalist. I was born in Iran to Iraqi parents. I have a question for you. The act of killing one's child is an outrageous, unacceptable act. But to me, this action as a mother represents the deepest love one can have for one's child, to save a child from life of slavery. Seth also represents strength, not weakness. If she was weak, she would have taken her own life, not her kid's life. Do you agree?
So do you agree that Seth was both strong and loving, perverse though it may sound, to kill her child?
I do agree. I think that took courage. I imagined it, you know, just with not, you know, I said not with a child, with mine. Could I, in fact, take my infant son and cut his throat for any reason? I just couldn't get there, really. But she would have believed, and she says she believed, that what she was doing was just moving them from this mortal world of woe and putting them someplace else. The real life story, the woman tried to kill all of them. All, you know, she had three. And she didn't succeed. She hit the boys in the head, and she cut one's throat. By the time they caught her, they put her on a boat. There was a trial, and they said that she was property. The abolitionists were trying to have her tried for murder. And that was legally a problem, because if she were tried for murder, that would be an admission that a slave mother had control and responsibility and obligations to her children. So no, they tried her for theft of property. And the slave owner won. But he figured out he couldn't get any decent work out of her, so he sold her, what they call downriver, down to New Orleans, down the Mississippi. And twice she threw herself and the baby in the water. And they hauled her out, not the baby, the baby drowned. Twice. And she was on her way out of this world. You know, I think the phrase I've used before is, it was the right thing to do, but she had no right to do it.
Toni Morrison, we've got a question for you from Amadou Monday, who lives in Jos in Nigeria. It connects with the ideas of reincarnation and Setha's belief that there is another life. He asks, hi, Toni, how much is the appearance of beloved, or the reappearance of beloved, connected to the African belief in reincarnation?
I would think it would be very closely connected in Setha's mind, because she's come back to me because she needed her, and besides she had to explain. But even if she had not, Setha would have believed that she was somewhere being reincarnated in some way and joining that whole family. Remember, Setha's mother was killed, hanged, probably running away, and she didn't get to talk to her.
Toni Morrison, you've been talking now, and in the book also there is this general acceptance that the young woman, beloved, who turns up is the reincarnation of the baby who was killed, is the ghost made manifest as a young woman. But I wondered how much room you felt you had left for people to, for readers to think, nah, she wasn't really, I can understand that they believed it. There is one point when the character Stamp Paid says, in passing, that there was a young African-American mm-hmm. woman who was kept locked up in a hut for years and mm-hmm. used as a sex slave by mm-hmm. the man who'd locked her mm-hmm. up. Maybe that's who this mm-hmm. beloved is. Now, I'm a cynical Londoner. I slipped into that bit of permission you gave me and thought, I don't know whether she's really a ghost. Maybe she's a real kid. Did you want people to be able to take it one way or the other?
I did because I thought, you know, we hear stories now about children sold as sex slaves and kept in whatever until they die or, you know, whatever. So that sexual life, sexual encounter that was underneath slavery, I mean, it's very thick. I thought maybe if that were the case with this girl who would have lived under those circumstances until she was a teenager, and suppose he died, and she escaped in some clothes, and she had just seen, and he called her these names, beloved being only one. You know, it's not quite like that, excuse me, Austrian guy with the daughters and the... Sorry. But I mean, almost, that's beyond the pale. But suppose that were the case. The point is that when she shows up, with this limited information and limited knowledge about who she is, and she's looking for somebody like Setha, some mother, that perfectly merges with a girl who had been on a slave ship and her mother had abandoned her. I placed alternate storylines or biographies for her in there, deliberately, because they both are bizarre. If she were a real girl who had lived like that, that is startling to me and is outrageous to me as somebody who just reappeared as a ghost. But it is true. I wanted you to take that path if you chose.
Well, Setha absolutely doesn't take that path. She becomes totally convinced that this young woman, beloved, is the child she killed. Would you read another episode from the novel or a passage from the novel in which we're now in Setha's voice, and it is at the point where she is totally accepted,
oh,
beloved,
yeah,
as her daughter?
Yes, beloved. She my daughter. She my... See? She come back to me of her own free will, and I don't have to explain a thing. I didn't have time to explain before because it had to be done quick, quick. She had to be safe, and I put her where she would be. But my love was tough, and she back now. I knew she would be. Paul D. ran her off, so she had no choice but to come back to me in the flesh. I bet you baby Suggs on the other side helped. I won't never let her go. I'll explain to her, even though I don't have to, why I did it. How if I hadn't killed her, she would have died. And that is something I could not bear to happen to her. When I explain, she'll understand it because she understands everything already. I'll tend her as no mother ever tended a child, a daughter. Nobody will ever get my milk no more except my own children. I never had to give it to nobody else. And the one time I did, it was took from me. They held me down and took it, milk that belonged to my baby. Nan had to nurse white babies and me too because Mam was in the rice. The little white babies got it first and I got what was left or none. There was no nursing milk to call my own. I know what it is to be without the milk that belongs to you, to have to fight and holler for it and to have so little left. I'll tell beloved about that. She'll understand. She my daughter. The one I manage to have milk for and to get it to her even after they stole it, after they handled me like I was the cow. No, the goat, back behind the stable because it was too nasty to stay in with the horses.
Toni Morrison, thank you very much. You're listening to the World Book Club from the BBC World Service. A question for Toni Morrison from the audience here.
Hi, my name is Kelechi Wimene and I live in South East London and I'm currently an A-level student studying your book. I wanted to know, what are your views about the nature of men in the novel and to what extent does your personal experiences reflect in the content of the nature of men?
I beg your pardon. My personal... Well, I have to tell you, my personal experiences have nothing to do with my novel writing. Nothing could be more boring. The men in almost all my work are very complicated people, not stick figures. They may be heroic in some instances and they collapse in others. They're always, always very supportive of women. Paul D. seemed to me to be very much like some other men that I have written about. A little bit of pragmatism combined with romance. I don't mean love romance, but the romance of life. And I think most of the novels that I have written, and somebody earlier said, oh, they're very sad and they're full of doom and gloom. But I think I have never written a book that didn't have a happy ending. Because my view is that if somebody learns something that they didn't know at the beginning of the book and had some kind of epiphany that was useful at the end, that's called happiness. They're not in the same, you know, either ignorant or inexperienced or wrong position they were. Paul D. saves her. He comes back, he walks through that house, and he asks the fundamental question. She says, oh, she left me, oh, she left me. And he says, you are your best thing. He gives her herself. And that for me was not, it was more important than reconciliation to life. It was returning this woman who had poured everything into this other stuff. And she had just disappeared in her own story. And everybody else was disappearing with her. Poor little Denver. I mean, you know, imagine growing up with a woman who killed your sister. So she's trying to be as, you know, steady on as she can. But Paul D is the one who returns her to herself.
Another question for Toni Morrison.
Hello, my name's Maria Margaronis. I'm thrilled to be here with you today. My question is about that harrowing, unspeakable scene of Beloved's death. When we finally come to that scene in the novel, we see it first from the point of view of the white men who come to take Setha and her children back into slavery, and then through the eyes of Baby Suggs and Stampede, and finally Setha herself. It's the only time in the novel when we see through the white slave owner's eyes, and it's absolutely chilling. I wondered if you could talk a little bit about your decision to write the scene in that way.
Well, because that was the thing, I wanted to bury it in a sense. It's so big. It's the thing that she did. But having it looked at from the outside, the way it was, remember that newspaper article I told you about? They were slave catchers. That's what they did. I mean, not just the owner, but he got these other people. And at that time, you remember, slaves could escape to a free state. But the law was that if the owner wanted to, he could take them back. But, you know, I was trying to find that page where she actually talks about what it took to kill her children. And I was sort of thumbing through. I couldn't find it. I mean, I eventually found it, but it's not in, I mean, most scenes, you know exactly where they are. And it's so buried in there. And it's because I wanted to have the reader come up on it slowly, you know, not start out that way. You know something happened, but I wanted the shock that Paul D felt when he first heard about it, you know. But I did want, you know, to sort of get there in slices and to have the most normal response to the murder from the people who were chasing her, who had no sympathy for her, and they were stunned, you know.
Toni Morrison, thank you for that. Another question from the World Book Club audience. Yes.
Hi, my name's Nora Sutton and I'm from Bristol, where I'm completing a Master's in Ethnicity. And I'm interested in the encounter between Setha and Amy, the white girl who helps Setha give birth. You once said that race is the least reliable information you can have about someone. It's real information, but it tells you next to nothing. This is a view I wholeheartedly agree with. Is this reflected in Setha's and Amy's encounter?
Well, yes. Amy uses the language of racism, because that's all she knows. But that's not what she does. Besides, she's alone. If there were some other white people around, she may have behaved differently. But she's all by herself. She's in the same category, really, as Seth. I mean, not pregnant, but socially. So therefore, she can do this thing. If you just withdraw the racism. And what happens under those circumstances is that people have to do something else. When you meet a stranger, if you just like the category, that's easy. It's facile and you don't have to think through it. It's easy and it's safe. But she uses the language that she knows about black people. But she takes care of her feet. And she heals her. And saves her. And takes her all the way through that birth. Which is the instinct of one female to another under those circumstances. And I wanted very much to emphasize that in the wild and alone, this is how people react. And Setha understands that she names her daughter after her. That was a significant encounter for me in the book.
Is there somebody in the front row there who'd like to ask a question? Yes, right here.
Hello, I'm Emmy. I am 9 years old. When did you first make your first book and how did you settle about publishing it?
My first book was a book called The Bluest Eye. And I wrote it, took me 5 years because I sort of liked the act of writing it. I happened to be in publishing at that time as an editor. That did not help, however, with the publishing of the book because they didn't hire me as a writer. They hired me as an editor, and I was sort of keeping the act of writing secret and published with another company. But at that time, there was a certain kind of book, I thought, that I would like to read. And I had never read a book in which a young black girl was central. They were always somebody's joke or some peripheral creature, but they never carried the weight of a whole story. And so I wanted to do that. By that time, after I'd finished that book, all I knew is I never wanted to not have a book in mind to write.
Emmy, am I right in guessing that you're in the process of writing a book?
Yeah.
You are. Thought you might be. Thank you very much indeed.
Good luck, Amy.
Toni Morrison, we have one last question for you. We have a question for you from Angelia King in Shanghai, in China. And she writes, "Dear Toni Morrison, Beloved is based on a tragedy, many hardship and unhumane situation. But most impressive part is the main character's determination to win freedom for themselves and their offspring. What is the effect of this history on today's generations of African Americans?" By which I think she means the history of having to win freedom and for themselves and their children.
You know, it's an interesting question because the obvious answer is you produce a stronger DNA in the race and they remember these extraordinary heroic things that have gone on historically and the struggle against, you know, layers and layers and layers of oppression and so on. It's like being tempered, you know, in fire. But something else is operating. In the States, anyway, there have been some enormous strides that African Americans have made in the United States. And there have been one path which is very responsible, very powerful, very consequential. And then there's another path which is influential and profitable, but it's almost as though the history or that blackness or being black is a product. I mean, you can actually sell it. Fashion-wise, you know, music-wise particularly. New music that is not even designed. You know, jazz was designed for other black people. Some layers of music now is for white boys out in Long Island, so it has a different thrust. It loses its political edge. It moves into something purely commerce and shock value. Although the music doesn't necessarily go that way, but sometimes the language does. What music did for us all these years, whether it was gospel or spiritual or blues or jazz, that was overwhelmingly supportive and expressive and creative. So you didn't really need novels because you had the music. And then there were the lore that was passed down from one generation to the other. But when the stories stopped being told, I thought that maybe now is the time to write the novels, you know, within the community, so to speak, to speak to the community, to write and bear witness for the community. I don't know if this clarifies anything for you, but most of the books written by African Americans in the 30s and 40s and 50s were addressed to white people, whatever they were about, because I can hear it. You think of the title of a brilliant book by Ralph Ellison. It's called Invisible Man. The question becomes, invisible to whom? Not to me. So I was trying to go inward and patterning it, the audience would be the community, which, like the music, even though it was within the tribe, so to speak, if it was any good, it would be accessible to anybody, everybody. I mean, you can hear good jazz in Japan and Poland, but you know its origin. So it's not isolated, it's not contained, it's not narrow. It's opening up itself to anybody. And I wanted to write that way so that it was very specifically about this, but write it in such a way that it was understandable, applicable, and even enlightening as well as revelatory to anybody from any culture. That's what I wanted to do. Did I answer that question? Did I lecture somebody on something else?
It's a very good answer. And that is all the questions we've got time for. At the same time next month, our World Book Club guest will be the American author David Gutterson, talking about his political courtroom drama, Snow Falling on Cedars. Do join us for that. And coming up shortly, somebody who was in fact a student of Toni Morrison's. The Pakistani novelist Mohsin Hamid will be answering questions about The Reluctant Fundamentalist, a slim, tense thriller set in the shifting shadows cast by 9/11. If you'd like Mohsin Hamid to answer your question about The Reluctant Fundamentalist, email him care of worldbookclub@bbc.co.uk. Or you can text him by dialing your international access code followed by 44 77 86 20 60 60. That's 44 77 86 20 60 60. And please tell him where you're writing from. For now, though, from me, Harriet Gilbert, and my producer, Karen Holden, thank you to all the members of the BBC World Book Club, whether listening at home or here at London's South Bank Centre. And thanks especially to this month's guest, Toni Morrison.
Thank you.